Right, well, let's just remember that the one reason for this talk today is that this is Alan Turing's centenary year. So we're marking the 100th anniversary. It'll be on June the 23rd this year, and there are a number of events all around the world marking this special year. So thank you very much for the invitation to speak here on this fascinating subject. Now, I'm not going to give a talk about mathematics, and in fact I'm going to take the opportunity to give a rather unusual talk, and it's a wonderful chance to talk in an LGBT political history way in something I don't often get the opportunity to do, so I'm very grateful for that. But let's just think about who Alan Turing was. Indeed, he was a mathematician, and he was the founder of computer science. I mean, he was essentially the inventor of the computer. And besides that, he was the chief scientific figure in the Anglo-American code-breaking effort of the Second World War, centered on the now famous, but then deadly secret, Bletchley Park. And as such, he is simply one of the key figures of modern history. So let's begin with Bletchley Park. Let's begin with Alan Turing. Actually, that's a picture of him in 1936, and he was 24, and he has a quite happy look there because he just achieved something great in mathematics. I would like to think about his time at Bletchley Park to get a picture of the centre part of his life, which is, of course, of enormous interest to everyone now. And here he was, in fact, in the early days of the war, established in this cottage, actually, and it's in the grounds of Bletchley Park, almost unchanged from as it was then. And this was the point where he did the groundbreaking work on the Enigma deciphering, which changed everything in the war thereafter. In fact, it looks a bit unbelievable seeing that picture, but being there at that point, he and the other colleagues of his, other mathematicians particularly, were roughly parallel to the leading physicists who found themselves taken out of pure research in 1939 and drawn into the atomic bomb project. But there are great differences as well as parallels, and one is that the code breaking had actually much more impact on the Second World War than the atomic bomb did. And another is this, that the atom bomb was immediately famous and physicists became celebrities. And the exact opposite happened of the thousands of people who worked at Bletchley. Everything about what they'd done was a completely secret for 30 years, and no one outside knew a thing. And that's a very important part of considering who he was and what he did, and what I'm going to describe later, which is the history of how his life came into public consciousness, because it's the historical aspect of it that I want to address in this opportunity. So what did Alan Turing do specifically? Well, he did one wonderful observation to do with the logic of the Enigma, which meant that he was able to design a machine called the bomb. It was based on some Polish ideas, but far more powerful. This machine was a central part of the Enigma deciphering process, and I'm absolutely not going to explain how the Enigma worked or how the bomb worked, but I'm going to give you a picture of picture of what we're talking about here. This was Alan Turing's absolutely central invention in 1939 that carried through. Hundreds of machines of this type were built, both in this country and in the United States as well later on. And they worked away on all the military and naval messages of the German war machine. And They weren't the whole story by any means, but they exploited a wonderful logical loophole which Alan Turing spotted. They were almost also enormous feats of electrical engineering, only really just possible with the engineering of the day, and an enormous achievement to make it possible at all. And that was Turing's thing. I mean, with important inputs from the engineers and from mathematical colleague. But that the most wonderful observation. And going on from that, the group that he headed attained really complete control of Atlantic communications. I mean, he specialised into looking at the naval messages, which were the ones with the greatest security protection, the most difficult and also the most vital in the, at least in the Western War. It was the Atlantic War, the connection with the United States, that was most vital, and it was essential to the invasion of Europe in 1944. And indeed, it required top-level liaison with the United States, so that Turing went on a top-level mission in November 1942. And in that role, he had access and input into every other top-secret question of codes and communications between the Allies. I mean, I'm just emphasizing that he wasn't someone who just did a bit or broke a message. He was the top guy as far as the scientific work in the whole of the Atlantic sphere between 1939 and 1945. Now, it was only in 1974 where a number of insiders, for different reasons, began to disclose this colossal scale, this industrial scale, the scale of an information factory involving thousands of people. Only then did it emerge, and only then did Alan Turing's name emerge as the chief scientific figure. And, of course, by that time, he had been dead for 20 years. And in his lifetime, the public hadn't the faintest idea that he had done any of this, and only a handful of people in the world had the faintest idea how this machine and the other amazing machines that were built later on, how they actually worked and what they did. It was unbelievably secret. But this revelation in the 1970s did bring his life into focus for another reason, a very interesting reason, and that's to do with the computer, which is the other element of his major achievements. I mean, most people in the 1930s, when they knew Alan Turing as a Cambridge mathematician, as a graduate student or postdoc in modern terms, they'd have said, well, it's a pure mathematician, pure, you know, nothing to do with the real world, and the last person you would imagine to be involved in military things or indeed official things of any kind. That just wouldn't have seemed to be him at all. But that pure mathematics, rather like the pure physics of the atomic physicists, was turned by the challenge of Nazi Germany into something with a very, very worldly application. And that was his story, that the pure turned into the very highly applied through the experience of Bletchley Park. I mean, he, as a mathematician, had a very wide range, but the central ideas were thought, logic, methods, machines, symbols. And it was that world which he completely revolutionized in the 1930s and then brought forward into the computer world of the 40s. In 1936, he had published a paper with the incomprehensible title of On Computable Numbers with an Application to the Entscheidungsproblem. Not the most snappy title, and my advice to young scientists is not to include long German words in their titles. And in the middle of this was a very prophetic passage indeed, and it contained these words: the universal computing machine. It is possible to invent a single machine, etc., etc. And that is essentially the concept of the computer, an unknown concept then in 1936. Only a paper concept then, setting out a mathematical theory, but something which turned into the computers that we all use now. Now, until that period in the 1970s, when these revelations came out, it was really a complete puzzle as to why this pure theorist of the 1930s had emerged in 1945 as someone who had designed a computer, because that's what he did, and not only designed it, but it was built, and you can see it in the Science Museum now, it's on the ground floor. This is the ACE computer, based on Turing's computer design in the Science Museum. And how was it that this strange, pure, unworldly person had suddenly become this computer boffin in the 1940s? Well, the Bletchley revelations answer that question. He had learned so much and gained so much from the technology of code breaking in those 6 years of war. I mean, they were years which were like an experience taken from the future. It was as if everything was 20 years ahead, both intellectually and technologically and socially too, in its whole ambience, and a very, very powerful experience for everyone in it. It was important for Turing, and very unusual for Alan Turing as a mathematician, that he got his hands dirty with actual machinery. It was very unusual for a Cambridge mathematician to be like that. And as an example of that, he actually built, in the latter part of the war, a very advanced speech scrambler using electronic components, and therefore gave him sort of hands-on practice for designing an electronic computer immediately at the end of the war. That was built with an engineer, Don Bailey, who I'll mention later on. So this has brought us to the claim that he was the founder of computer science and essentially the inventor of the computer. That 1936 paper I showed you is the foundation of modern computer science. And his 1945 work was to turn that theoretical idea into the practical reality of electronics. And this machine as the symbol of his eagerness to do what he called building a brain, as he called it, that was what he called it, because he was always most interested in what we'd now call artificial intelligence, the question of whether a computer can emulate what the human mind does. Now, I'm not giving a talk on computers anymore, not on mathematics, but I will point out that in the 1970s, this is really the period when computers began to be something like what Alan Turing had in mind. I mean, if you look at these weird computers of the 40s and 50s, the sort of thing you see in sort of Quatermass films, that really wasn't his idea. I mean, just these very expensive, difficult, isolated things. He had a vision, really, of where, which is really began to take shape in the 1970s with miniaturization, is much, much closer now that people can use computers in almost throwaway fashion. And it becomes the software that's important. It's software acting on software. It's downloading software. The fact that you can download software like downloading data, there's no difference. Software acts on other software, edits it, modifies it, and translates it. Those things, those were part of his vision. It wasn't the lumbering engineering that was part of his core ideas. It was everything that we associate with the universality of the computer now is the fact that software you can use to do all the different things that the computer does, is they made it the universal machine, that they handle photographs and CDs, that the same machine will be used for text processing, or indeed for doing this display, or for doing climate modeling, or playing chess, or doing filing documents. That is essentially the idea of universality, which was completely foreign to the world of the 1930s and took a very long time to catch on, even when he'd explained it. That's his world. And it's easy, comparatively easy now to see his idea of 1936. It wasn't then. Now, having said that, you may say, why in that case, I mean, well, surely he was famous for this after in the wartime, after the war, for doing this with computers. And, well, I mean, why wasn't he famous? Well, he has moments of fame. This computer project I've mentioned was in the press in 1946. He was in the press in 1949, he had little bits of film and newsreel, he was on the radio in 1951. But one important thing which I'll bring out is that he did not act as a big shot. He was very, very self-effacing. And it's also true that others were quite willing to efface him. And I'll give an example of that. I'll give one piece of computer literature here. This is the first book on computers written and published in, compiled in 1953, called Faster Than Thought. And this is the image of Alan Turing, which came out at that period in computer development, which was absolutely dominated by the engineering of these very, they were great triumphs of engineering, but they weren't really implementing his vision. He was seen, as you'll see from those words, as something really quite absurdly intellectual and out of the real world. Something that he'd done in 1936, and it was incomprehensible. This was the way that the computer engineering world of his time pushed him out. And in a way, Alan Turing connived in this. He did not fight back. He didn't do the kind of things you should have done to make himself a well known and important figure. And this is an element of his personality, which is also which is part of his life. In fact, he had a short piece in this book which explained the very ideas I've mentioned, the idea of the universal machine, but no reader of it would ever have realized that they were his ideas and that they were the ideas out of which the concept of the computer and everything about it had flowed. Well, that's a sad thing, and so also is this date. 1953, the next year, 1954, was when he died. And you, as you would have noticed already, the 1912 to 1954, this was a very short life. I mean, he died when he was 41. He effaced himself for reasons, there's a big story which I'll come to later, and at the time this was not a major event in the world. Essentially the waters closed over him. He was not, it was not marked as a great event, except very shocking to the people who knew him, but this was not a public, he was not a public figure. This did not come as a huge event at the time. But he was never completely forgotten, because mathematicians, they knew about these incomprehensible Turing machines, and he kept going on, as mathematics does, in its quiet way. His theories were certainly not forgotten. Just for this practical world, he seemed, in the 50s and 60s, a somewhat irrelevant figure. And that's, therefore, the situation when it began to change, and the revelations about the work at Bletchley Park very much changed the picture, because it turned out that if far from being this impractical person who knew nothing about the real world, he had been in charge of this department of Bletchley, hands-on experience which had day by day cracked the U-boat messages and essentially saved the Atlantic War. So from that period on, there's been a great period of uncovering hidden history in several ways. A fascinating business, the three hidden histories. One is the story of the Bletchley Park and its part in the history of the war, which had been kept concealed by Anglo-American policy. The second actually was the true story of how the computer emerged, and because that also had been falsified essentially by not knowing this great bridge of events between the theory and the practice between the 1930s and the 1950s. And the third was that of Alan Turing as a gay man. And of course only in the 1970s really could that be talked about. And I'll be saying something now, I'll now concentrate on that third hidden history. After all, this is LGBT History Month, and that's why I'm invited. But I'd invite you to see, there is a larger picture here of uncovering truth and seeing beneath and not believing everything that you're told, and knowing that there are many, many fascinating things that are there to be discovered. And in fact, these three hidden histories are linked through that one figure, Alan Turing, because his character and motivation, achievements, were the key thing in all of this, and someone who had essentially been disappeared in 1954. Well, how did this uncovering of hidden history take place? Well, I guess this brings to me, because I find that I'm gay history now, which I find a slightly disconcerting fact. It's a little bit worrying, this, but anyway, let me go back. Back to 1971, and the uncovering process began through the London Gay Liberation Front of that period. And it's in those circumstances that I heard a story about Alan Turing. And as a maths student at that point, it meant a lot more to me than it would to other people, because I had heard of him as a logician, as this pure, this strange, unworldly maths that he did. And the story came to me through these new gay activist channels, but actually through specific people who had known him as a gay man. And it was an amazing story, which we already heard the outline of. He had been arrested in 1952 for an affair with a young man, and he had been obliged to take estrogen implant treatment, essentially chemical castration, as the would have been essentially the alternative to prison. If he'd refused, he would have gone to prison. And that had done him, well, no good at all. Obviously an extremely shocking, humiliating effect. And this was the background to his death 2 years later in 1954. Well, we included this story in a little pamphlet that we in the GLF wrote. It was a pamphlet about the then dominant psychiatric picture of how being gay was a major personality disorder and so forth, which was the prevailing view in those days. I mean, it was a supreme example of a psychiatric oppression. And we published it, but I must say, no one took the slightest notice of it in those days. I can't recall the slightest reaction to this revelation. But then in 1977, that's when I learnt about the Bletchley Park story in quite a normal way, just in the BBC television series of that point. But I had some extra Oxford mathematics input, which told me that it was a bit more, that it was actually Alan Turing who had been the most important person. And I was astonished and fascinated by this as well. And I realised that Alan Turing's death in 1954 might very well have involved something extra, a very intense and very frightening issue, not just a typical case, though the way he'd been arrested was actually extremely typical of 1950s events, but there was something extra. There was the issue of gay men as security risk, and he was the top expert in these unbelievably secret events, with knowledge both British and American. And I certainly wanted to find out more about this, that these stories I've described, these hidden histories, had connections. That's what I sensed. In fact, what I really had was the idea of trying to tell that story from a point of view in which Alan Turing's own experience and consciousness would prevail. That was not original to me, that idea, because the whole idea of writing gay history, of the history from underneath, the unwritten history, had already started in the early 1970s. All sorts of fascinating things about the past that had come out through gay liberation thought. But it was a new thing, I think, to try and combine this with science and indeed military history. Now, there was no help to me from published sources for the simple reason that everyone who'd written about Turing had simply omitted everything about his life as a gay man and what had happened in that period, 1952-54. I mean, everyone just thought that was the proper thing to do. I mean, obituaries just did not say anything. I mean, the whole idea of everyone thought was proper was just to eliminate the existence of lesbians and gay men from the sense of history and ongoing events. That was thought, and it really only changed in the 80s. But as it turned out, Alan Turing's own, well, actually, I have to slightly disagree with what the Vice Chancellor told you. He wasn't so closeted. He was actually particularly open to a lot of people. And for instance, in the Manchester environment, which was a pretty macho engineering type environment, he was actually particularly open to all. People didn't call it that then. They called it his integrity. That was the word that was used. But those things helped me enormously. I mean, he left an enormous goodwill behind him of people who knew that something had gone absolutely, there'd been some absolutely dreadful injustice that happened in this period. And by the 70s, I'd say that many people had never discussed these things for 20 years since they'd happened, or more than 20 years probably, and were at that point were able, in fact, in many cases, when I was researching, it was like a kind of therapy, actually, to go through these questions. Quite a number of letters, no diaries, unfortunately, but the thing was that his friends had saved from destruction the things which otherwise had got generally, tend to get eliminated. And they remembered magic lines that he had spoken, which showed me the way that a new kind of history could go. When I think back to some past epoch, Alan Turing would say in conversation, I think of who I was in love with at the time. And I'll have a go at telling some of the epochs of his story in that light, which is a rather different light from the technical and military and worldly history that I've given so far. All right, so the first, let's go have a look at, I'll give another story about Turing from a different, it's the same story but looked at from the other side. I mean, the whole point of what I'd say is the unity of the mind here. It's not that there's one Alan Turing who did the science things and there was another one who was gay. The point was it was the same person, and that's so much part of what we have to say in the whole equality movement to which we are, that these things are to do with the unity of the personality. They can't be separated off. And I'll try and bring out some things which are in his work, which show that unity. And this is the first thing, really. This is Alan Turing at school, 1929. Alan Turing on the left. And his other lad, Christopher Morcom, on the right. And Christopher was certainly the first great love, unrequited, I'm sure. But a very important, well, several important things. Christopher suddenly died in 1930. It was extremely traumatic. But before he died, he was the person who really brought Alan Turing out of intellectual isolation into a world of science and communication rather than of solitude, because he's very isolated as a boy. So a very important part to play and taught really advanced things, relativity and quantum mechanics, as well as chemistry experiments. I mean, this is the picture on the right that I think Alan Turing kept in his rooms throughout his life. And thoughts about the event of his death played a very important part in Turing's early philosophical explorations when he was a student at Cambridge. It's the questions he wrote about, the question of what is the nature of mind, how can it be embodied in the brain, does quantum mechanics make any difference, what is the nature of free will, determinism, and how so forth. Those are questions which he didn't answer directly in his work, but came back again in his thinking about artificial intelligence and stimulated his questioning of what logic, what science could tell you about mental operations, which is really the subject of his 1936 work, which, as explained, actually gives rise to the computer. That's a sad story. There's a happier one coming up. That's my favourite picture of Alan Turing. I think it's 19 on the island of Sark, and I think that's really rather how he would like to be remembered himself, and it's certainly, I think, what he would like to see. He would like to see quite a lot also. I think it's quite a good picture of his romantic imagination. And there was at Cambridge, his next relationship was with another mathematics student at King's College, James Atkins. An event somewhat like this event happened on the Lake District when they were walking on the hills there, and James became a first boyfriend, which lasted several years on and off in the 30s. It was actually James who I met in the 1970s, so that gave me a lot of very curious channel into this early part of Alan Turing's life. King's College, where by chance, really, Turing had gone to study mathematics, was, of course, peculiarly sort of gay, tolerant, Bloomsbury Group, Maynard Keynes, all those people. So it was a very supporting environment. Alan had his sort of bride's head moments. He had a teddy bear, which they all did in the 20s, but that wasn't really his thing. He was much more, unusually for those, he really fought against this aesthete athlete distinction and was actually more on the athlete side. He was very keen on rowing and did cycling and running and boating, he liked a lot as well. It's an interesting question, which I don't know the answer to, how much consciously he fought against the kind of stereotyping of gay men as being, intellectual gay men as being of an aesthete sort of. I don't really know, but he did rather take against that. For that reason, he wasn't completely a King's College sort of person. But he was in other ways, because, I mean, he was vaguely leftish in the anti-war movement of 1933, and like other people, progressed through the 30s through the anti-fascist importance of understanding the challenge faced facing the West from Nazi Germany, and into such a position that he would, instead of being anti-militarist as he'd been in 1933, felt compelled to take part in the war. Another couple of photos. Oh, out in the middle, that's the rowing team there, and two right in the middle, they're not a very good picture. Another little snapshot, 1933, 1934. Another picture of him. I'm showing at the right of the picture, just caught in this snapshot, this slight sideways, out of the frame look is actually, I think, quite appropriate for him. He was not the sort of person who was at the centre of social events. He was there at the edge. And this is at Princeton, where he went for 2 years after the mathematical success of the paper in 1936, which I described. Here, rather a desert as far as love interest is concerned. But he was doing all sorts of things. One of them was thinking about cipher machines, specifically with the war with Germany in the offing. So he was the most effective anti-fascist, where his friends were mostly concerned with exhortations. He was actually doing something very useful preparation. Back to England and King's College in 1938 with his cipher machine, and actually a lot of interest in a young engineer who helped with him, and that's again part of the story, that he actually certainly develops a romantic interest in his collaboration of his ideas and the practical abilities of other young men. That's part of the erotic area in which he seemed to thrive. And at King's, it was probably Maynard Keynes who knew Turing well, who put him on to the code-breaking establishment, the government code and cipher school, as it was then, because Turing was taken on very rapidly at the time of the Munich crisis in autumn 1938. It may actually have been Keynes's gay connections with the echelon of people who'd done code-breaking work in the First World War that actually brought about that. So there's a bit of hidden history there, which should be interesting to know more about. Meanwhile, actually, Alan sponsored... Oh, yes, he has... Well, this is not a very clear snapshot, I'm afraid. This is on the... at Bosham, on the south coast of England, where... this is right in August 1939. It's at the critical point of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, where all Europe is just waiting to see what would happen next. He was boating, and there's another fellow, King's Fred Clayton, on there, and there are two boys who they'd rescued from Austria and sponsored and did a bit of... didn't pay for completely, but helped to come over to England. So again, that was a little bit of practical anti-fascism at that point. And it was Bob, it was one of those boys, that he, when Chamberlain announced the outbreak of war on that Sunday morning in September 1939, as Bob, who was there, told me, he was there in the room, and that's how everything changed. So that's the that's the setting. That's a nice picture of the informality out of which this whole world of the code breaking then developed. So while at the same time as saving the Atlantic and all the other things that he was doing, of course, Alan Turing had his own personal life going as well. Not an easy one to carry through for a gay man, really. And in fact, that was a point where a remarkable thing happened, because he could very well have been tempted at this point to follow the kind of conventional line that other people did, including the other fellow of King's who's in the picture there and who got married, and indeed Maynard Keynes, who was married too. And this is a very common conventional pattern of people who could do it. It made life a lot simpler. One of the top mathematicians who became a codebreaker in Alan Turing's Naval Enigma section was indeed a woman, Joan Clark. And they got on extremely well. I mean, they were buddies. But as Joan put it, they didn't have a lot of physical contact. But it's something that could have worked. But this is a striking thing, that he decided this was not for him, this kind of sort of pretend marriage. This was not on. He told her specifically why this was. and it was very upsetting. In fact, when he broke it off, because they did actually get engaged, but when he broke it off, he actually quoted Oscar Wilde, "For each man kills the thing he loves." Of course, every gay man knew, and was hanging over the whole era, was the fate of Oscar Wilde, which in a way, of course, it was exactly the fate which came back for him later on. On the top level liaison to the United States in 1942-43, he reported anyway, he discovered some gay life in New York. It had been pretty well on the way back. And that's, I think, it may indicate quite a shift. Before this point, he had certainly been very full of need and response and desire for young men, but probably hadn't really accepted his identity as such. But after this period in the war and thereafter, he was much more clear and open and certainly determined to be more honest. And in working on the Delilah speech scrambler, which I described, with a young man, young engineer from the Midlands, who's absolutely astounded, really. I'd never met anything like this before. Alan Turing was very open with him and told him all about his being gay. It was a remarkable thing. That was not what you're supposed to be doing in 1944. But he got away with it, I think, essentially because of this, what people call integrity. I mean, it was so natural for him to say openly and honestly that it was accepted. Certainly Donald Bailey was very amazed that someone should tell them that they had these feelings and that they were, as Donald Bailey told me, almost proud of it. And that's the earliest reference I've had to the concept of gay pride in a very surprising context. The context, incidentally, where Alan Turing conceived of the idea of the electronic computer. I mean, this is where the computer came from. It was this base in northern Buckinghamshire where he was working on the speech scrambler in this funny setup with a Midlands engineer. Well, I must run on a bit more, but it gives you some flavour of what sort of gay man he was. I mean, to present him as a victim and so forth is only part of, it's a very important part of the picture, but he was a real person. I want to put that over in this talk, because there's one opportunity to do that. A real person who did all these mathematical, technical, philosophical things, but also had a very complex and quite sweet life of his own. Lots of other things he did. He was very keen on running, and after the war, when based on the computer ACE developments, joined the local athletic club. That's Alan Turing on the steps of the bus. They're just off to a meeting there, and then there's another picture of him running there. He was extremely, actually trained very hard, actually, and did marathons as well as other long distance. He was actually nearly on the Olympic team in 1948. For reasons which I'm not going to go into, he was impatient with the computer development at the National Physical Laboratory, and he went off to Manchester, but meanwhile had a bit of time at Cambridge in 1948. There he met actually what was the most steady boyfriend that he had, that's Neville Johnson, who was a Geordie student. But the difficulty there, I think it might have kept up very well, but it was just an impossible separation, long-distance separation of their jobs, and it was not able to keep it up. That was a great shame. So Alan Turing left this comparatively protected and elite Cambridge environment for Manchester, which, of course, is extremely different. It was a very grimy industrial city of the late 40s. And a very comparatively macho engineering kind of ambience there. But he seemed to actually like being in the more ordinary world. There's a very strange paradox of him, really, that he was very individual, very peculiar, absolutely unique and so forth, but actually he liked ordinary things in a lot of ways. And he didn't actually want to be treated as a very special person. It was in Manchester. Well, his role in the computer didn't really work out very well, but he did write one very famous thing. His paper about artificial intelligence, written in that period, very famous for the Turing test, was written in that atmosphere. And that's a fascinating paper to read just in this, from this side of his life, from this story's point of view, because it's full of comment about human life. Although it's about what machines can do, it's comparing machines with human beings, and unlike almost any writer, certainly computer writer of that period or any period, it's full of remarks about human life, about his and love and feelings and his clearly his own feelings and his own life, own sense of progression through life is most important to it. Full of slightly innuendo type remarks as well, because that was what he was like. He was full of jokes. One person who was, this is Alan Turing on the right, at the console of the Manchester computer, and you can see not exactly fitting in very well into the ambience there. He's in it, but not of it. He had an interesting colleague there, Christopher Strachey, who had a very similar mentality. Christopher Strachey may be known to some Oxford people here because he headed the computer laboratory here and in fact was an organiser of the campaign for homosexual equality here in the early 70s. So that's a nice Oxford connection. But at Manchester they had this slightly camp take on artificial intelligence, and Christopher Strachey wrote machines to make this machine, programs to make this machine write love letters, which is, that shows that's the kind of fun and mentality which Turing was able to put into this environment. It was a serious beginnings of artificial intelligence programming idea, but made fun. And he also got it to play Jingle Bells, the first computer music, which was played on the BBC radio at Christmas 1951. Now, talking of Christmas 1951, indeed speaking of Oxford, Alan Turing didn't have any direct connection with Oxford at all, but he did with the Oxford Road, which is the main road which leads south out of Manchester Centre, past the university, and that's the place where the railway bridge is, where it was the centre of the working class gay scene, as indeed is now. And there's by the Milk Bar, that's where he met a young man who caused the events which became so traumatic. And that's those people who've seen the play Breaking the Code will have seen a reasonably accurate depiction of the events that took place. So I won't go into all the details of that, but it was a classic story of the 1950s, and nothing special about it at all. But what happened was that Arnold Murray, who was the young man of 19 that Alan met, somewhat boasted of his making this connection with a professor to a friend of his in the Milk Bar, and the friend burgled Alan's house, and Alan took it as a form of blackmail, which indeed it was. I mean, it was this assumption that you couldn't go to the police about it, because if you did, you would be found out. Well, he did go to the police, making up some sort of story about how he knew who'd done it. He was arrested on the 7th of February 1952, which you may notice was 60 years ago yesterday, and therefore one of the first acts of the reign of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. It's an unfortunate start to the era was to arrest the man who had done so much to save old Blighty in the war, but there we are, that's what happened. I mean, he's often said to be very naive for doing this, for going to the police, it was exactly this naivety and lack of cunning which actually has been the great motor of change in the end. It's this willingness to be honest and stand up to things and not just cringe, which has really made all the difference. So I don't really follow this point of view. It's been, in the end, it's been a greater strategy to push things on a bit. He told the police when he was arrested that he thought there was a Royal Commission sitting to legalise it, and it shouldn't be illegal at all. I mean, that was his view. And the police were very amazed by this. They had never met anyone who stood up to the questioning and took this line that he'd done what he'd done and there was nothing wrong with it. everyone was supposed to cringe and say, I don't know what came over me and this kind of thing. Well, that's what he didn't do. He also told Donald Bailey, who I described to you as to do with the speech scrambler, that he'd written to a politician saying the law was so wrong, and there was a politician whose son was gay. Well, I don't know who this was, actually, but it shows that he had an attitude. He wasn't just a passive victim of events. This was someone who was standing and would like to have shaped events, but of course was completely powerless. And he also wrote a short story, which really was just a disguised form of the events that had taken place. It was just for himself. I don't think he was trying to publish it or anything. And an interesting thing about it is that he actually used the expression gay man, which was a new expression for those days. I mean, normally they would all use the word queer. But he had sensed this new American word which was coming into use and had a more modern flavour. And that's rather typical of everything that was happening in this period, that the 1951-52 period saw enormous increase in the number of prosecutions, and also meant that it became a public issue for the first time instead of being completely unmentionable. And it was that increase in the number of events which led to the public discussion and therefore to the Wolfenden Commission, which was set up later, after Turing died in 1954. So in that increased consciousness as a reaction to increased persecution, Alan Turing was very much part of the process. That is the local newspaper account of what happened at his trial on March the 31st, 1952. And you'll see those words, organotherapic treatment, which is indeed the estrogen implant and which I described before. This is indeed what happened. And his, which he endured, I mean, his solutions were, as I've described, there's a certain amount of increased consciousness, also in greater contact with his friends. The great support of a gay peer network was most important there. And he had other mechanisms as well. He started seeing a Jungian psychoanalyst, Franz Greenbaum, and of course we'd have no idea really how these sessions went. I think in a very theoretical sense, he might have felt life would be a lot easier if he was bisexual, or I mean if he could have done the kind of thing that other people did. But as he says, Robin Gandy, oh, it'd be so boring. And as he said to Lynn Newman, who was wife of Max Newman, the mathematician, who he's very friendly and intimate with, said, I just can't believe it's as nice to go to bed with a girl as with a boy. And it was young men that the coach generally thought about. And the only way for that now was to go abroad. And when he went to Norway in 1952, it's almost certainly because he was attracted by news of the early Scandinavian gay movement, which he may well have seen these. I mean, he may quite possibly have seen these magazine pictures from Denmark in 1951. I'm sure he'd have loved it. And he actually learnt Danish and Norwegian. I think he was probably very attracted to the idea of escaping to Scandinavia. And he went to Norway in 1952 and met a young man. And indeed, his programming was influenced by his experience in Norway, because you may just be able to see that this machine code program written here, it's called the Ibsen routine. And he had other routines which are named after Norwegian youths and so on. And this is not a very serious connection with his work here, but a nice picture of what he did. But this led to further crisis, which, from what he said, was a crisis as full of incident as the Arnold story. That is to say, something happened in 1953 that was equally traumatic to the arrest and trial in 1952, but he did not tell anyone what it was, apart from clues, little clues. And this is one of the clues, these words here, this is a letter that he typed out on the Manchester, using a Manchester computer, so it was like a sort of email when you hadn't got email. Very sort of nerdy thing to do, but he quite liked things like that sometimes. And you see, the words are a crisis about den norske gutte. It is actually the crisis about the Norwegian boy who visited in 1953, or rather tried to visit him in his home, but failed and was turned back by police, who then he found were watching him the entire time. And this was something serious had happened, and did he? It's really a question of whether he realised why he was being watched so closely. It's not something that normally would happen, and it seems fairly obvious that this was because he was not any gay man of the 1950s period. He was the top person in Anglo-American secret communications. And this, I think, is probably in a somewhat state of denial about the significance of this fact. It is the paradox of his life. He wanted to be an ordinary gay man, when at the time you couldn't be a gay man at all, really, but he would just like to have been sort of just normal carrying on. But at the same time, he wasn't ordinary. He'd been this most important person he could possibly be in things which are deadly secret, kept completely secret for another 20 years, and which also shared with the United States, which was in the middle of the McCarthy crisis and general paranoia. So the really surprise is that things went on as long as they did, rather than they led to a crisis in 1954. Well, he didn't let this stop him. He actually went to Greece, went to Corfu, Athens and Paris in the summer of 1953. I know he brought back a whole page of names from he'd met in Athens, and I know this because I saw it in, of all places, the Atomic Weapons Research Establishment, Aldermaston, where he'd got muddled up with a stack of his papers. I've seen it, but no one else has, because the nuclear scientist who had it destroyed it, because it shed such a terrible light on what sort of person Alan Turing was, and that is the history that we have to try. I mean, that is the destruction of history that we have to try and recover our way out of. Well, I think you can see that this gives a whole background to his death in 1954, which is not just a simple question of collapsing because of exposure or being outed in 1952. He was in a very, very special position, and we don't know what happened that time. But there could very well have been another crisis if he was unable to go abroad again. That could very well have been the last straw. I'm coming to this is the final. It's a very well-known symbol now. It's the bitten apple. He used the device of taking cyanide, but left this theatrical prop of an apple, which those who wanted to believe could believe he had eaten with cyanide on it by mistake as part of doing the chemistry experiment. I mean, basically, that was a kind thing to do. Suicide hurts other people so much, and it was a way to allow people, if they wanted, to believe. It was a joke against his own amateur chemistry experiments, own clumsiness, if you like, something his mother had always nagged him about since he was a boy, all those things, but of course a wonderful symbolism as well, because this is, well, it's several things, and it's certainly the expulsion from innocence. I mean, he had given up his life as a pure mathematician for the sake of the war against Nazi Germany. It was in 1938 that he made that switch, at the very point, actually, when he'd seen the famous Disney Snow White film, which he certainly liked very much, and he often remarked upon, where Snow White, dip the apple in the brew. That very point, and that very connection with the wilderness of state secrecy was, I think, probably the most difficult thing in 1954. That was a very paranoid time. It was the same week that his counterpart, Robert Oppenheimer, was denounced as a traitor in the American press. But on the other hand, you see, that very willingness to lose their innocence for doing practical worldly things was the excitement. I mean, it's a sexual thing too, because it was what drove a lot of his feelings and needs. And it was the thing which led to the embodiment of the computer and took it away from being something that was purely a paper theoretical thing. That was a great excitement of starting that revolution, and something he couldn't resist. The whole longing for practical action was, I think, bound up with his sexuality as well. It was indeed indeed his fatal chemistry experiment. So these hidden stories are actually very closely connected, and there's lots more, of course, which I hope may interest you to find out about. But I think there's just one very simple thing to end with, that it was just 60 years ago, Alan Turing just wanted to be free, ordinary, gay, honest. And it seems to have taken a very, very long time for the world to catch up with this. Oh, thank you very much.